Imagine you're walking into this incredibly sterile, intensely lit hospital room,
Right.
and the monitors beside the bed, they're beeping with this just flawless rhythm.
Yeah, totally perfect.
Exactly. And the medical charts at the foot of the bed are like 100% accurate. The medication dosages have been calculated down to the absolute microgram.
Precision engineering.
Right. Technically, from an engineering standpoint, the whole system is flawless. But, and this is the kicker, the patient in that bed feels entirely profoundly abandoned.
Wow. Yeah.
And you have to ask why. I mean, if all the data is correct and the protocols are executed perfectly, what on earth is missing?
Well, it's the gap, right? It's the gap between a correct protocol and an actual human reality. Because the institution has successfully managed the biology, sure, but it has completely failed to hold the person.
That is just wow. And that's exactly what we're exploring today. We're getting into this radical idea that argues, perfect data, correct theories, and flawless policies are just, they're simply not enough to sustain human life.
No, not at all.
Or a civilization for that matter. Because if we only look at the world through this lens of data and like mechanical fixes, we suffer from what today's grounding source calls life blindness.
Life blindness, it's such a heavy term.
It really is. And whether you're listening to this deep dive right now while analyzing corporate systems, or maybe you're redesigning a public space, or honestly just trying to figure out how to maintain a halfway decent connection with your family in this crazy world, this framework we're unpacking today is going to fundamentally shift how you view the structures you inhabit.
It really will. And for some context, we are diving into a really fascinating academic white paper. It was published today, actually, May 30, 2026.
Brand new.
Exactly. It's by Dr. Pachara Saley, and it's titled The Poetics of Life Coherence.
Which I have to say sounds incredibly abstract at first glance.
Oh, totally. The title is very lofty. But the mission of the paper, what Dr. Saley is really trying to do, is intensely practical. He's trying to map out what he calls the poetic transmission layer of life. Basically, the core thesis is that human beings do not live by arguments.
We really don't.
Right. I mean, we don't wake up and arrange our days around a logical syllogism or, a white paper.
Yeah, nobody does that.
We live by tone, we live by gesture, by rhythm, by the physical structures around us, and ultimately by care.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit because life coherence, I mean, that's a heavy piece of terminology.
It is.
When I first read that, my mind immediately went to some sort of, I don't know, utopian, perfectly aligned existence where absolutely nothing ever goes wrong.
Right, like some kind of Zen garden where everything is just easy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the text actually pulls it right down to earth. Life coherence is presented as this very simple, albeit profound, diagnostic question.
Wow.
And you can apply this to literally any space or relationship.
Yeah.
The question is simply, does this pattern of relation preserve and expand life, or does it degrade it?
And we really have to pay attention to the word pattern there.
Right. Why is that so important?
Because the author is arguing that you cannot just mandate life-affirming behavior from the top down. You can't just pass a corporate policy that says everyone in this office must now experience life coherence.
Right. Mandatory coherence starts at 9 a.m., guys.
Exactly. It doesn't work that way. Coherence has to be transmitted. It has to be felt in the environment before your conscious brain even understands it.
So to understand how that transmission actually works, we have to start with probably the most misunderstood, maybe the most trivialized concept in modern society. We have to look at beauty.
Which is such a brilliant starting point, honestly, because starting with beauty forces an immediate confrontation with all our default assumptions.
Oh, totally. Because in our modern framework, beauty is just, it's the cherry on top. It's the decoration.
Right, it's an afterthought.
Yeah. If you're building a school or a hospital, you figure out the engineering, the budget, the square footage first. Then, if there's like a little money left over at the very end, you buy some nice paint or you hang a painting in the lobby. We treat beauty as this aesthetic
Or
luxury.
just a purely subjective preference, like, oh, that's nice to look at. But the text introduces this radical redefinition.
Yeah, it completely blew my mind.
Dr. Saley argues that beauty is not an ornament, and it is certainly not a luxury. Beauty is a coherence signal.
A coherent signal.
Yes, It is the felt appearance of right relation.
Okay, I have to admit, I really stumbled on that phrase initially. The felt appearance of right relation. It sounds beautiful.
Like hard to grasp at first.
Right. But the paper draws this very sharp distinction that really clarified it for me. It separates what it calls captured beauty from living beauty.
Yes, that part is so crucial.
And if you look at the mechanics of captured beauty, I mean, it is basically what drives the entire modern economy.
Oh, 100%. Let's break down how captured beauty actually functions.
Please do.
Mechanically, it is designed to narrow your attention. It commodifies an aesthetic to mask an underlying incoherence or sometimes even violence.
Wow.
Think about a highly produced, visually stunning commercial for like a fast fashion brand or a meticulously filtered social media post.
Oh, yeah. The ones that look just flawless.
Right. The image is designed to dazzle your visual cortex.
Yeah.
It completely hijacks your attention, but it leaves your actual relationship with the world completely untouched or honestly impoverished. It's essentially a mask.
It's like a neon sign for a diner that serves terrible food.
Yes. Perfect analogy.
You know, like the sign itself is captivating. It draws you in. But the reality underneath is toxic. And the text contrasts that directly with living beauty.
Right.
Which does the exact opposite mechanically.
It really does. It doesn't narrow your attention at all.
No, it widens it. It restores proportion to things.
And it awakens a sense of care.
Right.
The examples the text uses for living beauty are not these grandiose architectural wonders. They're deeply grounded.
Like what really stood out to you?
Well, things like a truthful apology.
Mm-hmm.
Or a well-tended community garden. Or even a scientific explanation that reveals the hidden order of a biological system without reducing the living organism to a mere machine.
Wow.
Living beauty makes you feel more responsible to the world around you, not detached from it.
Okay, I have to stop you there, though, because I can hear the objection forming from anyone listening right now.
Sure, lay it on me.
The old adage is that beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
So how can something as wildly subjective as beauty be a reliable diagnostic signal for objective right relation?
That's a very fair question.
Because if I love, like, brutalist concrete architecture and you love cozy wooden cabins, who is objectively seeing the coherence there?
Well, the author isn't talking about aesthetic taste, you know, blue versus red or concrete versus wood.
Okay.
The paper actually frames living beauty as an epistemic tool.
Epistemic meaning.
Epistemic referring to how we acquire knowledge. Dr. Cicilli argues that we actually recognize structural coherence through form before we even possess the conscious vocabulary to explain it.
Oh, that's fascinating. Ground that for me, though. What does that actually look like in the human nervous system?
Okay, think about walking into a courtroom.
Okay, a courtroom.
If the architecture is designed entirely around intimidation, so the judge is elevated 30 feet in the air, the lighting is harsh, the acoustics make every single footstep echo aggressively.
Oh, I'm already stressed just thinking about it.
Right. Your nervous system reads the room immediately. Your vagus nerve registers threat and hierarchy before a single word of law is spoken.
Wow.
Your body just inherently knows the relation in that room is built on domination.
Contrast that with one of the specific examples from the text. A quiet room set aside specifically for truth-telling.
Exactly. Imagine a room with softer acoustics, maybe circular seating, lots of natural light. Your nervous system reads safety and equality. You recognize the truth of the room aesthetically, physically, before you ever process it logically.
You know, it's like the difference between a fast fashion jacket and like a coat handed down from your grandfather.
Ooh, I like that.
Because the fast fashion jacket looks incredible on an Instagram feed, right? It is designed down to the pixel to be captured beauty. It hijacks your attention.
Totally.
But when you actually put it on, the zipper catches, the material makes you sweat because it doesn't breathe, and the seams literally tear in a week. It dazzled your eyes, but it completely failed your body.
Yes, exactly. It's a facade.
But the grandfather's coat, it might not be flashy. It might even look a little worn.
Sure.
But the stitching is incredibly robust. The wool regulates your temperature perfectly, and the pockets are exactly where your hands naturally fall. Your body understands the integrity of the coat, the right relation of the materials, way before your brain analyzes the thread count. That is living beauty.
That is a perfect translation of the mechanism. The form must carry the message. And the text gives these incredibly quiet but devastating examples of this.
Yeah, they were beautiful.
A candle lit beside the dead. A carefully prepared meal brought to someone convalescing. These aren't just decorative acts. They are how life speaks in the dark. Asserting that even here, relation matters.
But, you know, beauty is inherently fragile. A beautifully held room for truth-telling is incredible, but eventually the meeting ends.
Right.
People go back to their stressful jobs. The feeling just kind of fades.
It does.
So how does a society prevent that living beauty, that coherence, from just evaporating when Monday morning hits?
Well, it requires a container,
yeah,
a structure to hold it over time. And the paper argues that we build those containers through ritual.
Ritual. Okay, the moment you say that word in a modern secular context, people instinctively roll their eyes.
Oh, absolutely. They check out.
Right. We immediately associate ritual with, like, empty superstition or maybe a really rigid religious ceremony that no one even remembers the meaning of anymore. It just feels irrelevant to serious systemic design.
And that baggage is exactly what the paper dismantles. Dr. Soley redefines ritual, not as a superstitious habit, but as cultural physiology.
Cultural physiology. Okay, physiological mechanisms regulate our physical body. So if I step out into the freezing snow, my biological physiology constricts my blood vessels to keep my core warm. It regulates me through a transition.
Yes.
How does a ritual act as, like, a hormone or a nervous system for an entire culture?
It regulates the social body through co-regulation. Think about what happens during a threshold. The text lists the major thresholds of human life: birth, illness, severe conflict, exile, institutional transition, and death.
The big ones.
The massive ones. And a threshold is incredibly dangerous because it completely unsettles your identity. The old version of the world is gone, but the new version hasn't stabilized yet. You are just in free fall.
So if a community goes through a massive trauma or a family loses a parent, the individuals in that system are completely dysregulated. Their nervous systems are just scattered.
Precisely. And if you don't have a shared form to cross that gap, the community fragments. People isolate, or they deny the change, or they act out violently.
Because they have nothing holding them.
Right. A ritual provides a structured, predictable container that actually slows the crossing down. Mechanistically, think of a funeral. You have 50 people in a room experiencing wildly different chaotic emotions.
Yeah.
But the ritual forces everyone to stand at the same time, to sit at the same time, to listen to the same cadence of speech, perhaps to sing the same notes. It physically synchronizes individual nervous systems to a collective baseline. It holds the individual so they don't shatter.
Wow. But just as there is captured in living beauty, the author draws a devastatingly sharp line between living ritual and dead ritual.
He really does.
Because we've all been part of rituals that felt incredibly hollow, if not outright oppressive.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
The distinction comes down to what the ritual actually serves. A living ritual restores relation. It opens the field and invites genuine participation.
Okay.
A dead ritual enforces conformity. It protects hierarchy.
Okay, I'm thinking about apologies right now. We see this constantly in the corporate world or in politics. A CEO makes a catastrophic error that severely harms a community.
Classic scenario.
Right, and then the PR department steps in and scripts this highly formalized press conference. The CEO stands at a podium, uses all this passive language like mistakes were made, and promises to do better.
Yep.
That is a dead ritual. It performs the mechanics of accountability, but its actual function is to protect the CEO's status and suppress any real emotional fallout. It leaves the core abandonment totally intact.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, compare that to a living ritual of reconciliation, like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, or even on a micro scale, a mediated restorative justice circle.
So different.
Completely different. A living ritual demands that truth be spoken plainly. It requires the offender to sit in the discomfort of the harm they caused without the shield of a PR podium.
No hiding behind buzzwords.
Right. A living ritual carries the grief and anger of the community, whereas a dead ritual tries to sweep it under the rug as quickly as possible.
And the text gives a really stark warning about what happens when a society abandons living rituals. It says that unheld grief or trauma doesn't just evaporate just because we refuse to acknowledge it.
No, it goes subterranean.
Subterranean, right.
The author states explicitly that what cannot be held symbolically by a culture will act itself out physically. If a society lacks the living rituals to process grief, that energy returns as symptoms.
What kind of symptoms?
Things like widespread anxiety, mm-hmm. addiction, ideological extremism, or the scapegoating of marginalized groups.
It completely reframes how we look at our daily interactions. Even something as mundane as a clinical exam. A doctor walking into a room with a clipboard, if it's a dead ritual, the doctor's just a technician troubleshooting a biological machine.
Right.
But if it's a living ritual, the text describes it as a morally charged meeting between vulnerability and responsibility.
Which is a heavy burden for medical professionals to carry. But it is necessary because the most intense threshold any of us will ever cross, the ultimate test of whether our rituals actually hold weight, is the end of life itself.
And that leads us to probably the most profound argument in this entire paper, the assertion that grief is the deep test of life coherence. Dr. Saykali argues that you don't discover a society's true values by watching how it celebrates success or how it rewards innovation. You discover its true values by watching how it holds loss.
And the definition of grief in this section is just, it's quite staggering. Grief is love encountering finitude.
Love encountering finitude. I mean, that means it's not a malfunction. It's not a psychological defect that needs to be medicated away. It is the necessary ache of relation after irreversible change.
Consider the mechanics of what actually happens when you lose someone. You aren't just experiencing a feeling of sadness inside a world that has otherwise remained intact.
Right. Everything changes.
The geometry of your world has literally reorganized. The chair at the table is permanently empty. The voice on the phone is gone. The future you projected into tomorrow no longer exists.
Yeah.
To grieve is to be forced to live in the after. And a life-blind society simply does not know what to do with the after.
Because it disrupts production.
Yeah.
It disrupts our illusion of control. So modern institutions panic. They privatize the grief. They medicalize it.
Yes, they do.
They give you, 3 days of bereavement leave and then expect you back at your desk, fully functional, as if a monument hasn't just collapsed in the center of your life.
A life-blind society treats sadness as a pathology, and it treats death as an institutional failure.
I really want to push back on this, though, because I want to look at a highly practical, deeply emotional scenario that a lot of people face.
Sure. Go ahead.
Let's say I'm in the ICU. My parent is dying. The medical team comes in and says, look, there is an experimental treatment. It will be agonizing. The odds are terrible, but it's an option.
Okay.
My immediate raw human instinct is to say, do it. Fix this. Save them.
You're suggesting that the paper views that instinct to fix as potentially damaging.
Mm.
Isn't trying to fix someone the ultimate act of care?
It is the ultimate act of desperation, driven by love, yes. But the author introduces a vital concept here called accompaniment.
Accompaniment. If we connect this to the bigger picture, accompaniment is distinct from fixing. Accompaniment is the willingness to remain present and in relation when a problem absolutely cannot be solved.
Remaining present when the tools fail.
Exactly. When we rush to apply another agonizing intervention to a fading body, we have to ask a really hard question. Who are we actually treating? Are we treating the patient's pain, or are we treating our own inability to tolerate their departure?
Wow.
The text argues that the opposite of grief is not joy. The opposite of grief is abandonment. When we treat the dying person as a battlefield where we must achieve victory, we actually isolate them.
I see what you're saying, because if the illness is a battle and the patient is fighting, then what happens when the biology naturally inevitably fails?
Right.
The person dying is subtly made to feel like a loser, like
yeah.
They just didn't fight hard enough. They're failing the institutional metric of survival.
And that is a form of temporal and spiritual violence. The paper goes really deep into what it calls life-coherent dying. It acknowledges, of course, that modern medicine is a miracle. It extends life and relieves immense suffering.
Sure.
But medicine crosses into incoherence when it confuses resisting death at all costs with serving life.
The mantra in this section that I just couldn't stop thinking about is, cure may end, care must not.
It completely reorients the medical mandate. There is a specific threshold in end-of-life care. At a certain point, the interventions stop relieving suffering and start merely extending the dying process, often due to institutional momentum or fear of litigation.
Right.
When a hospital says, there's nothing more we can do, what they actually mean is, there is nothing more we can do to cure.
But there is an infinity of things left to do to care.
Precisely. If cure is off the table, care scales up. Mm-hmm. Mechanically, what does that look like?
Right. Practically speaking.
It looks like aggressive symptom management so the person isn't in pain. It looks like dimming those harsh fluorescent lights, which brings us back to our concept of living beauty.
Yes.
It looks like telling the truth gently, so the patient doesn't feel gaslit by false hope. It looks like releasing them from the anxiety of having to fight, just for the comfort of their family.
It's really about recognizing that how we accompany the dying fundamentally teaches the living what life actually means. If death is hidden away behind sterile curtains, life becomes shallow. If grief is rushed, love becomes an unsafe investment.
And rushing, that is the connective tissue of this entire problem. Why do we medicalize death? Why do we lack living rituals? Why do we rely on captured beauty?
Tell me.
Because our culture is paralyzed by an obsession with speed.
Which brings us perfectly to the mechanics of time. Why are we rushing the grief in the first place? The paper diagnoses the engine of our daily anxiety by drawing this really sharp distinction between mechanical time and living time.
Mechanical time is the clock. It is the Excel spreadsheet, the quarterly projection, the absolute metric. It assumes time is uniform and linear.
But living systems don't operate on mechanical time. It's like trying to run human sleep cycles on a spreadsheet.
Good luck with that.
Right. You can highlight a cell in Excel and type output, 8 hours of REM sleep. But the human nervous system is an analog instrument. It requires a wind down period, darkness, a drop in core temperature, emotional safety. You cannot dictate living rhythms with digital inputs.
You really can't. Living systems have a tempo. They experience phases of latency, explosive growth, rest, maturation, and recurrence. When you force a living process into a mechanical rhythm that violates its inherent nature, the text calls this temporal violence.
Temporal violence. That term makes so much sense of modern burnout. It's the rushed medical consultation where a doctor has exactly 8 minutes to deliver a life-altering diagnosis. It's the rushed apology that demands immediate forgiveness because the conflict is inconvenient.
Or it's expecting a community to bounce back and move forward before the truth of a trauma has actually been integrated.
So what is the alternative? Because if you are managing a hospital or running a business or honestly just trying to get your kids to school on time, you can't just abandon clocks. Delay can also be a form of violence, right? If an emergency room operates on slow time during a cardiac arrest, people die.
Well, the author is very clear that the alternative to speed is not slowness. The alternative is right timing. The text introduces a concept from Taoist philosophy.
Oh, way.
Wu Wei, which is often translated as non-doing or non-forcing action.
Yes, but in this context, it doesn't mean passivity. It means doing nothing extra. It is action in perfect relation to the field.
Can you give me a tangible example of Wu Wei in a modern professional setting? Because to be honest, it sounds a little bit mystical.
Sure. Think of an experienced trauma surgeon. When a patient arrives bleeding, the surgeon moves with blinding, rapid precision. That is Wu Wei.
But the next day, when the patient is in recovery, the tissue needs time to granulate and heal. If the surgeon constantly reopens the wound out of anxiety to check the healing process, they disrupt the living tempo.
Ah, I see.
Wu Wei in recovery is the discipline of waiting. It's knowing when to intervene rapidly to save a system and knowing when to step back because the system needs time to mature.
So it's the intelligence to stop before care mutates into control. And the paper argues that a massive part of this temporal intelligence relies on how a society views rest.
The text treats rest as a civilizational necessity, not a luxury, and certainly not a biological flaw.
In the current paradigm, you know, sleep or taking a Sabbath or convalescing after the flu is viewed as a failure of output. It is inefficient downtime. We literally have an entire industry of biohacking dedicated to minimizing the amount of rest a human body requires so we can just return to mechanical time.
It's absurd. Rest is a coherence-preserving rhythm. A society that cannot rest becomes a self-consuming machine. Without rest, our neurological attention decays. When attention decays, our perception narrows, which means we can no longer perceive living beauty. When perception narrows, our care becomes entirely mechanical. And as we've discussed, mechanical care eventually becomes violent.
So we have a society plagued by temporal violence, a society that doesn't know how to rest, how to grieve, or how to cross thresholds. The existential question is, how do we stop passing this massive heavy anxiety down to the next generation?
The paper pivots right here to the concept of childhood. It introduces the idea that a child is not an incomplete adult waiting to be filled with data. A child is coherence information.
They are sponges for relation. The text argues that children do not inherit life coherence through formal lectures or moral instruction. They inherit it through the atmosphere of the adults around them.
What the author calls their felt ontology, the repetitive physical and emotional realities they conserve in their nervous systems.
If the adults around them are constantly vibrating with temporal violence, rushing, extracting, optimizing, the child learns that the world is a place of threat. They learn hypervigilance. They learn that their fundamental worth is tied directly to their measurable performance.
Conversely, if a world conserves rhythm, tenderness, and safety, the child learns trust. The text specifically highlights play here.
Yeah, that was a great section.
Play is not just recreation or killing time for a child. It is their natural mechanism of Wu Wei. It is where they rehearse complex social relationships, test physical boundaries, and process fear without the pressure of external domination.
But the section that I found most liberating, because honestly, no parent or teacher can perfectly curate a stress-free atmosphere, is what the text says about rupture and repair.
It is an incredibly forgiving framework.
The text acknowledges that no family, no school, and no institution is perfectly coherent. Adults get exhausted, they lose their temper. Miscommunications happen, ruptures in the relationship are inevitable.
We're all human.
Exactly. The critical metric of a healthy system isn't the total elimination of rupture, it is the capacity for repair.
Let's look at the mechanics of an adult apologizing to a child.
Yes, walk me through that. What is actually happening physically when a parent kneels down and says, "I was wrong to yell at you, I was stressed, but that wasn't your fault, and I am sorry."
Mechanistically, the child's nervous system has just experienced a threat, the yelling. Their stress response is activated. When the adult initiates genuine repair, taking accountability without blaming the child, the adult is using their regulated nervous system to co-regulate the child.
Incredible.
The child learns something profound structurally. They learn that conflict does not destroy relation. They learn that truth can be spoken, that power can be questioned, and that love survives accountability.
It builds incredible emotional resilience. Because if they never experience repair, they assume any conflict means abandonment.
And the paper scales this up beautifully. It states that this is civilizational training at the most intimate scale. A society that lacks the humility to repair ruptures with its children will never possess the tools to repair ruptures between its adult citizens. How we treat the developing nervous system of a child is the literal blueprint for our societal future.
So we are teaching children how to live through the atmosphere we create. But what about the tools we use to share the ideas that shape them? This brings us to the final major theme of the paper, the meta layer of Dr. Saheeli's work, the knowledge commons.
This section turns the lens onto the format of information itself. The author argues that you cannot transmit a life-coherent idea using a life-degrading medium.
The medium is the message.
Exactly. If you write a brilliant framework about living relation, but you lock it behind an impenetrable academic paywall written in dead, alienating jargon, you have contradicted your own content.
You are preaching living beauty while practically enforcing captured beauty.
Precisely. The text introduces the concept of the knowledge commons as a poetic vessel. It isn't just a digital hard drive where we dump PDFs. It is a living ecology of transmission.
And to understand what a commons is, the text contrasts it with a platform. So what does this all mean? I want to spend some time here because this defines the digital water we all swim in. What is the mechanical difference between a platform and a commons?
It comes down to what the architecture is designed to extract. A platform captures attention. Its algorithm is engineered to monetize engagement. And to do so, it fragments the user's psyche.
Oh, definitely.
It feeds you outrage to spike your dopamine and cortisol, trapping you in an infinite scroll. It views the person purely as an engagement metric.
A platform essentially asks, how do we keep the user trapped in this loop so we can serve them more ads?
Yes. A commons, however, cultivates attention. It deepens participation. A commons actually has friction. It has an endpoint. It receives the person as a living being and asks, what does this person need in order to re-enter their actual physical life more coherently?
The author borrows a term from the philosopher Ivan Illich here, convivial tools. A convivial tool is one that serves life and extends human agency rather than dominating the user.
Right.
A bicycle is a convivial tool. You control the pace. A social media algorithm designed to addict you is an industrial tool of domination.
This raises an important question, though. How do we consume information? Are we treating knowledge as a tool for domination and status, or as a convivial tool that serves life? Because this requires us to think about how we format knowledge.
Very true.
People enter understanding through different doors. The academic needs the rigor of a white paper. The commuter needs the accompaniment of an audiobook. The visual thinker needs a diagram that instantly reveals the shape of an idea.
And a deep dive like this one creates a conversational entry point. It's actually why the text includes a life-coherent publishing checklist in the appendix. When you are putting an idea out into the world, the questions aren't about SEO optimization or maximizing click-through rates.
No, not at all.
The questions are, is this format beautiful enough to invite genuine attention? Is it humble enough not to dominate the user? Does it serve life, or does it merely produce content for the sake of noise?
It is a radical proposition.
Mm-hmm.
It demands that we ask whether knowledge itself can be healed. Can we stop using information as a weapon for status and start using it as a tool for repair?
What a monumental journey this has been to pull all these threads together. We started with the realization that logic and engineering are just insufficient to sustain us. We have to train our perception to recognize living beauty as a signal of right relation. We need to build cultural physiology through living rituals to cross dangerous thresholds.
Yes.
We must reframe grief not as a malfunction, but as love encountering finitude, moving from a paradigm of aggressive cure to compassionate care. We have to reject hapral violence and respect the living tempo of the systems around us. We must protect the atmosphere of childhood, teaching trust through the profound act of adult apology. And finally, we have to treat the knowledge we share as a healing commons, not an extractive platform.
It is a breathtakingly comprehensive vision. But as a final synthesis, it is vital to remember Dr. Sakili's own warning here. Life coherence is not a static utopia. It is not a magical state where conflict vanishes and everyone is perfectly happy. It explicitly includes disturbance, illness, severe conflict, and death. Life coherence is simply the ongoing dynamic practice of asking in every single situation before you act. What does life require here?
What does life require here? I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over as you transition out of this deep dive and back into your physical reality. We spent a lot of time talking about how the world teaches us how to live. We talked about how children inherit the atmosphere around them.
Right.
But consider this. To the people in your life, your family, your coworkers, the barista you buy coffee from, the child you were raising, you are the world. You are the atmosphere.
That's a powerful shift in perspective.
So, what is the tempo of your presence? Are you a source of living time, or do you bring temporal violence into the room? What unconscious rituals are you enforcing in your home or your office? Do you invite truth-telling, or do you enforce conformity? Tomorrow morning, when you step out your door and into your day, ask yourself, what kind of world are you transmitting to the people who cross your threshold?
A profound metric for a life well lived.
Thank you for joining us on this journey today. Thank you for offering your attention and for taking the time to truly engage with these ideas. Until next time, take care of yourselves and take care of the atmosphere you create.